something. What have I screwed up? I'm certain I've screwed something up. So.
For the record, the Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, today's date is Thursday, February 9th, 2012. And for the record, we also have quorum. The first bill today is Senate File 1620, Senator Cruz. That will be followed, a little change in order. Senator Harrington will take number two spot today, followed by Senator Gazelka's bill as the follow-up. Senator Cruz, are you in the room? Welcome to the committee, Senator Cruz. Senator Cruz, is this the first time you've been before the Judiciary Committee?
This is not, Mr. Chairman. This is actually the second time I've been before the committee.
Thank you
for having me. Thank you, committee members.
Then, guys, the hazing plan doesn't have to go into effect.
We'll be gentle.
Yeah, I've heard
you
that before.
Move in that direction. Senator Cruz, Senate File 1620.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. It's a pleasure to be before you today. I think we have a great piece of legislation before us. We have Senate File 1620, a piece of legislation concerning eminent domain. Essentially, what we're trying to do in this bill is create, through the condemnation process, a little bit of equality in the system for those who are having their properties taken through eminent domain. Right now, what we see is a little bit of discrepancy between the eligibility portion and the amount portion as we move through these and those who have access to an ALJ hearing. And so we're trying to address that through this legislation. This bill would essentially, if somebody does not accept an acquiring authority's denial of relocation assistance, this would allow them access to that. So today with me, I have Mr. Kirk Schnichter to explain the bill in a little bit more detail.
Mr. Schnichter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for having me,
Would you
Chairman.
Identify yourself for the record, please?
My name is Kirk Schnichter, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm an attorney, and I practice in the area of condemnation law, specifically with an emphasis in the area of relocation law. I've represented both government agencies and private entities, although 95-plus percent of my experience is representing private individuals and in eminent domain-related matters at this time. When a person is displaced because of a government taking, if they're a homeowner or a business or a tenant, they have certain mandated federal and state rights we call relocation benefits. And it's a process. It's an administrative process, whereas the government needs to provide assistance and provide claim economic assistance to individuals who are being displaced. From time to time in that process, there can be disputes when the parties don't agree exactly how much that relocation assistance might be, or in the case of the particular matter that we have today, whether or not an individual is eligible for relocation assistance. When they have a disagreement in those matters, in the state of Minnesota, the current law as it is right now is you have the right to an administrative law judge hearing. This hearing process was established in 2006, and it was part of the eminent domain reform, and it was a matter that my office, John Morphew, who's an attorney who's Thank with you. Me, sitting behind me, participated in, and we came to the legislature and talked to then-State Representative Abrams and asked him if he would sponsor some legislation to say, hey, we would like to have administrative law judge hearings be the rule of law in all hearings involving relocation claims. He agreed, and the reason why we requested that was because prior to that time, the level of due process and fairness that you got was really kind of all over the board. At the state of Minnesota level, if you're displaced by the state, by the Department of Transportation, for example, you got an administrative law judge hearing, and it was a fair process, and you had your day in court. On the other hand, there was other cases with some cities and counties, and primarily with certain cities, where they just couldn't keep from trying to rig the process against you. Some cities, one city, in fact, they decided that they were going to turn around and appoint, the city council appointed themselves to be the hearing officer. Most people looked at that and said that wasn't fair. There was other ones where they appointed the city attorney, or they would appoint a city staff to turn around and be the hearing officer, and I can assure you most of my clients in those cases didn't feel like they were getting a fair hearing, and their relocation benefits were going to get a fair shot. And in those cases, surprise, surprise, they were always denied. So we got the law passed in 2006 that required that administrative law judges was the mandate across the state. There was one problem. We made one mistake in that statute, and that was the provision that said that it had to do with amounts of relocation benefits that were paid. Well, what's happened is a few units of government since then have said, well, if your dispute has to do with amounts, that's fine, but we've determined that you're not eligible for relocation benefits, so you have no right to a hearing. Well, we think that's unfair, and obviously, you know, people that are being displaced don't think that's fair. So it's really, in some respects, a housekeeping request that we're making a request that be changed, and simply that the law reads that both you're eligible, you get an administrative law judge hearing if your eligibility, if you're questioning eligibility, or if it has to do with the amounts. We've had some discussions with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I talked to Mike Moran, who's the chief relocation personnel at the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Mike Moran has indicated to me, I don't know if Mike's here today, but he could testify, obviously, and Mike has not indicated any opposition to this matter at all. You know, we've spoken to some of the folks at the League of Minnesota Cities, put them on notice in December or November that this was something that we were planning on proposing. And I did speak to one of their lobbyists yesterday, and they did have some concerns about fiscal impacts, and we think those are fairly nominal. On this particular matter, relocation appeals, whether it involves dollars or eligibility, they're pretty rare things that happen. My office handles more of them. It's a specialty that my office handles. And my guess in the state of Minnesota on an annual basis, from my own experience, it's probably two or three a year in the state at best. From what I understand, some folks say that there might be more than that. At the administrative law office, at the offices that handle these matters, I know over the last several years, since 2003, there's been one, two, three, four, five of them that have been heard. They're not real common. They're just, as we see it, it's an effort to turn around and make it a level playing field and be fair with people when they're being displaced. Finally, in all due respect to cities and counties in this matter, not all cities and counties we have problems with. Obviously, there's a lot of good cities, and some cities in the past, even when they weren't required to give us ALJs, bent over backwards to give us a fair hearing, but it doesn't always work that way. There's a few rogue ones out there that want to just turn around and at all stakes they want to win, and this law would at least give folks a fair shot on this issue of eligibility. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman and committee Cruz. Members, in conclusion, I guess I would also like to second those comments. With the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties, they have been absolutely phenomenal to work with on this issue. They've done a great job and continue to do a great job of reaching out and educating those local units of government. And I really feel like we've addressed most of those concerns, but we are sensitive to those issues, and we appreciate that their ability to work with us. I guess I'd just like to finish with, I think we need to take the process of eminent domain and condemnation very seriously. I think there should be a heavy weight put to this, and I think we should have a very strict process. You know, it's not something that should be taken lightly to take somebody's property away from them. And so I feel like this is a fantastic piece of legislation, and I hope we'll get your vote.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak for or against the bill?
Chairman, if I could, Judge Eric Lippman from the Office of Administrative Hearings is here today, and he's offered to be available if, in the event that anybody had any questions regarding the process He made it clear when I talked to him he's not going to rule from the testimony today on where he stands on things. I know that's how they are. But I wished he'd rule in my favor more often. But, no. But anyway, he did indicate he's eligible or he's available, and he did come here today in case anybody had any questions regarding the process.
Judge, do you need to speak or testify?
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Eric Lippman. I'm the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. I don't need to make any testimony on behalf of the bill. We never testify for or against, but I'm here as a resource and glad to answer any questions about the process.
Thank you, Judge. Anyone else wishing to speak for or against the bill? Any questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge Lippman, would I be correct that under the current system, the condemning authority is the authority that determines eligibility, and we are simply proposing to transfer that to the Office of Administrative Hearings? Is that it in a nutshell?
Judge Lippman.
Well, Mr. Schnitzker may have a view. I guess I'll take my run at it. Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, for the state highways and federal projects, the ones that the Minnesota Department of Transportation runs, and it's also suggested in the fiscal note, they give an administrative law judge hearing on eligibility and also as to the amount of relocation benefits that might well be required either by federal law or there's also a state statute on point. It's my understanding from Mr. Schnitker and others that with particular cities, again, it's not necessarily a state process, it's a local housing redevelopment authority, or it's a local road or some sort, and that because of their view of the law, and I think there is a particular case on point, the Wren case, which you could certainly, Mr. Schnitker was counsel in, there was a dispute as to, in that case, which was referred to our office, it was a local project out of Richfield, with respect to the Lindale Avenue, and in that case, there was a dispute over eligibility, and Judge Beck ruled that eligibility was a fair issue for the ALJ proceedings. I think the question that, as I understand it, the Cruz bill addresses is if you never refer it over to OAH, you'll never get a judge to say, yes, eligibility is part of our process. What I understood Mr. Schnitker to testify is there are some city officials, some condemning authorities that say, well, it doesn't say eligibility, it says amount, and even if the amount is zero, you don't get a hearing if the amount is zero. If it were above zero, you would get a hearing. Now, again, I don't know whether that is or is not the case, but it seems that the Cruz legislation would be an effort to clarify and indeed codify what I understand the Wren case to stand for, and that was affirmed on appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Mr. Snicker, Counselor, have I characterized Wren accurately or?
Accurately.
Mr. Snicker. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unless there's other questions, I would move Senate File 1620 with a recommendation that it pass and move to the Senate floor.
Sir Cruz, does this go to the floor? Any other committees?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is my understanding.
I have no. Senator Latz, I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure who would answer this question, but I note that the fiscal impact materials before us identify local fiscal impact and fear departmental earnings impact. And can someone, I'm sorry if I missed something on this before I came into the hearing today, but was there any information provided about what the local fiscal impact might be? Who picks up costs related to the proceedings? Is it the condemning authority? Will cities or counties be facing additional expenses related to this? And do we have any idea what that would look like?
Do you have any?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, the fiscal note came in at 6:30 last night, and we haven't had time to request an answer to the local impact. As for departmental earnings, that would be I think that they would be minimal because the Office of Administrative Hearings doesn't expect very many requests for hearing.
Mr. Chairman, I just out of, I guess, as a process question, I'm a little uncomfortable evaluating fiscal impact when there's identified that there will be local fiscal impact, but we don't have that information. And whether that's appropriately before this committee or perhaps a local government committee, I'm not certain either. But it's information, I think it's important for us as a state legislature to consider what costs we may be passing along or imposing or causing to be borne by local governments, that's also taxpayer dollars.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, and committee members, there's one sentence on local government costs and says there could be an impact on local projects where federal transportation funds are not involved. I'm not aware of how many projects that would entail. Perhaps our witnesses could tell us.
Mr. Schnitker.
Senator, members of the committee, the majority of the projects that we're working on are the ones that would be impacted by this legislation would be local projects, and they wouldn't be federal projects, because under the federal projects, almost all of them that I know, you're going to be entitled to they're going to give you an ALJ hearing. With the Department of Transportation, which is usually federal funds, you're going to get the administrative law judge for eligibility or for dollar amounts. But specifically, Senator Latz, to your question, I'm not going to deny there isn't going to be some impact at the local level. I guess the question is if we're already giving administrative hearings, fair administrative hearings for administrative law judges on the dollar amounts, then does it make sense that we also do the same thing to be consistent on the issue of eligibility? As to the cost, there is going to be some cost. It is going to be nominal. The rate for an administrative law judge hearing is they charge $165 an hour. They have occasional hearings. I think I've counted five claims since 2005, matters that have been taken up since 2003. In my experience, and the best estimate I can make, is there's probably as few as two administrative hearings involving relocation in the state of Minnesota annually. There probably could be more, but since I practice in this area and my firm is the only firm that specializes in this area, I doubt if there's very many more than that. So it's going to be a nominal amount as far as hearings, but undoubtedly there will be some impact on some entities that are going to have to pay for it. I do concede that. But they're not a very common thing, these administrative appeals in these matters. Usually the law applies. It takes its course. Government complies with the law. People are paid the benefits that they're entitled to. It's a fair, reasonable process.
So, Mr. Chairman, who then, maybe Mr. Schnitker, who bears the cost then of the ALJ in a situation where the condemning authorities offer or determination is suggested to be erroneous? Who refers it to the OAH? Who pays the cost of that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I believe the citation is 117.50, and it's the condemning authority that bears the cost. And I did pull the five most recent cases, as Mr. Schnitker suggested, the cost experience for our hearings of 2003. I don't know if there's a page. I'm glad to share that with members. We have enough also for members of the public who might be interested as well.
Yeah, I'd like to see those, please.
Is that okay with you?
Senator Wardman.
Mr. Chair, I would just say that the costs are within the local units of government's control. They're the ones that are making a decision to use the power of eminent domain or condemnation, and so they would have an estimate of the costs involved, including whether or not there's eligibility and whether or not review is appropriate. So I think that that's within their control, and this is certainly something that we should do to make sure that we fulfill the intent of the eminent domain revisions that we made to the law a few years back.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Ortman's point. And I've been around here long enough to know that the cities and counties are represented very well through all proceedings, and I guess my question would be to Senator Cruz, as the cities or counties representatives come to you about an exorbitant cost to them with your legislation at all?
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, those are the conversations that I had alluded to earlier. They have been absolutely fantastic in working with us on that. They are obviously cautious, as anyone would be, when you're presented with a potential increase of any sort in these difficult economic times. But the feeling that I was left with after that is they are assuming that, as Senator Ortman mentioned, these costs are going to be nominal. Even if you look at some of the largest cases on the sheet that's being presented before you, I would humbly say that those are most likely in control of most local units of government to handle those. And also, I would say that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that a local unit of government that chooses to use condemnation or eminent domain, we should take that as a weighty process, and part of that weight is the potential financial impact of that. I think that's a good thing. I think for Minnesotans that's a good thing to protect them in that way.
Any further questions? Hearing none, Senator Newman. Senator Latz.
I'm just going to say I don't have any problem with the concept. I thought it was important to get the information about costs that might be passed on to other units of government on the record, and I appreciate Judge Lippman having it available for our consideration. And the only other question I have about process is whether this is something that the local government committee ought to be looking at because of the impact on local government.
Senator Latz, the chairman of that committee has not brought it to our attention that he wants to see it. He certainly has the right to pull it into his committee later. Hearing no further discussion, Senator Newman renews his motion that Senate File 1620 be recommended pass and moved to the floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you. Next on deck is Senator Harrington, Senate File 1123. Senator Harrington, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Looks like it's old home week for you and your former comrades there.
The boys in blue are well in the house, and I appreciate having the mirrors back up.
They're always welcome. Please proceed.
Thank you. I'd like to move Senate File number 1123, an amendment to the gang nuisance law.
We'll follow up with the motion after presentation.
Thank you very much. This bill amends the definition of gang activity for purposes of the gang nuisance law to include unlawful possession of a firearm by a minor. There were in the original legislation on the gang nuisance law a list of firearms offenses that were already listed, but in actually using this legislation, we discovered that there was a gap there, and possession of firearms by a minor was one of those gaps, and we're seeking to close that gap up. The gang nuisance law is contained in Minnesota Statute 617.91 to 617.97, and it's established procedure under which city or county attorneys or the attorney general could bring a lawsuit to enjoin a public nuisance involving gang activities. As far as I understand it, the only place this has actually been used so far is within the city of St. Paul. The law started in 2007, and in 2009, the St. Paul city attorney, who was then John Choi, who's now the Ramsey County attorney, brought suit against two separate gangs for two separate public events, the Cinco de Mayo event and also the Rondo Days event. They brought a civil action enjoining the Serrano's gang in Cinco de Mayo and against the Selvysiders and the East Side Boys on the Rondo Day event. In both cases, these gangs had committed acts of violence. They had been disruptive to the good and order of the festivities and these family-oriented events, and we had sought to enjoin them from participating in the event so that we could prevent violence and prevent any further nuisance or disruption to the community. In both cases, the law was effective. We felt that we had good success there, but we did note as we were preparing these cases for preparation and presentation to a judge that we had certain members that should have been included in the action that were left out because they were juveniles who had not been adjudicated delinquent, and they had not been felons yet, so they were not included in the class or the group that we enjoined from being at the event. This bill would correct that, and I have three testifiers to speak to that. I have Commander Paul Iovino of the St. Paul Police Department. He is currently in charge of the St. Paul Police Department's gang unit. I have Officer Tony Spencer, who is also assigned to the gang unit as the Latino gang specialist. And I also have the Ramsey County Attorney, John Choi, who's prepared to speak.
Right. Who would you like to have speak first?
I'd like to have Commander Iovino speak first.
Commander? Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Iovino. I'm the commander of the St. Paul Police Department. I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, as well as committee members, to testify before you today. I'm here in support of Senator Harrington's proposal to amend the current bill. I can tell you from our experience that this was an impediment and a concern for the police department at the time. And we also know from past experience, I've worked both in the juvenile unit as well as the gang unit and have experience in this area, that juveniles are in possession of firearms, and it's concerning for a lot of reasons related to maturity, to public safety. But also gangs recognize that there are reduced sanctions for juveniles to be in possessions of firearms. So it's certainly a tactic within gangs to have juveniles possess those firearms as probationary members or up-and-coming or new members. We support the amendment to have this added. It's currently in effect for adults. We're simply asking to have the amendment be inclusive of juveniles as well. And we think that it would provide a more safe environment. It would allow us to have the predicate offenses needed for a civil gang injunction. And we think we've been very judicious in the past and the times that we've used this. Officer Spencer can speak specifically to a couple of those instances where it's been an impediment for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Officer, would you identify yourself for the record?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Tony Spencer. I am a police officer with the City of St. Paul, currently assigned to the gang unit working Latino gangs. Here today in support of the amendment, I can also speak from the time that we had utilized this at our Cinco de Mayo event. We had had some violence the year prior with a shooting that was very concerning to the neighborhood organizers of the festival. The year that we had utilized this civil gang injunction was by far and away one of our safest, most successful Cinco de Mayo events. I can say that, to reiterate the commander's point also, that the juveniles are used often within the criminal street gangs. In this amendment, I think, would effectively address some of those concerns that we have with our juvenile offenders in enjoining them in the future actions when we choose to utilize the civil gang injunction again.
Thank you. Any is Attorney Choi here. Mr. Choi, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney. And, a lot has been said about this bill. I just want to reiterate my support for this amendment to the statute. I believe that the civil gang injunction statute as originally enacted and how it's been utilized in St. Paul has been a very powerful tool. And I think it can be another tool in the toolbox moving forward. But if you make this improvement in the bill, I think this will give us more ability to make this a powerful tool and utilize it to combat gang activity. And there's a lot of safeguards that are already in place under the current statute about what we have to do in terms of proving all of these things. And so there are three elements that we have to prove. You have to prove, first of all, that this, in fact, is a criminal gang, and there are three or more incidents if that's the continuous and regular aspect of it, and then we have to prove gang activities. But with respect to gang activities, if you add this particular juvenile and unlawful possession of a firearm, I think that could be very helpful because, as the officers talked about, a lot of the members of the gang are juveniles. And so I think that would be very helpful. And so here I'm just here to support this amendment to the bill and encourage its passage. And I want to thank Senator Harrington for bringing this forward and you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak for or against this bill? Hearing none, are there any questions or discussion from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Troy, thank you for being here. And it's very interesting what you've been doing in St. Paul. I know that it has made those events more accessible for folks in the community. One of the summaries of the bill that I saw said that there is a proposed change in the procedure for obtaining that, and I didn't see that in the language. Doesn't it just add the one category for the possession of the firearm by the juvenile?
Mr. Choi.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, that's correct. That's all the bill is doing. It's a very simple addition to the bill to add unlawful possession of a firearm by a juvenile to one of the predicate offenses of establishing criminal gang activity.
And so, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Choi, does this also change the database that you're, does this change what kind of information might be included in a database tracking gang activity?
No, it should not. That's not our intention.
Thank you.
Senator Harrington, maybe following up on the concern of Senator Latz, is there any cost to this to the local community?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I'm not aware of any cost. We asked as to whether we should have sought a fiscal note on this and was told that given the way the bill is currently structured that there does not appear to be any fiscal impact to local communities.
Mr. Turner, do you have any perspective on this?
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Harrington's correct. There is no cost, no fiscal impact with this bill.
All right. Thank you. Senator Harrington. Senator McGuire.
I don't mean to interrupt, Mr. Chair. Just before you pass the bill, I just had a question.
No, I had a question of my own, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Harrington, and for an impressive panel. I just thank you for the issue. I support it. I'm just quite curious, do we have a lot of young kids carrying guns these days? Is it rising? Is it going down? And we've got some, you know, bills that are dealing with firearms, you know, in our legislature, and I'm just wondering how, what the situation is out there with kids carrying guns.
Mr. Chair, Senator McGuire. I'm going to defer briefly to Officer Spencer, who I think probably has probably a better handle on the current pulse in St. Paul. But I can tell you with my conversations, I teach classes on gangs statewide, and my conversations with, especially in Minneapolis, Hennepin County, and the surrounding Seven County metro area, that is the fastest growing and the most violent segment of our gang population are what we're now referring to as the hybrid gangs, which are typically made up of 13 to 17-year-old, typically young men who are loosely affiliated in their gang activity, but have been responsible for a number of the rather highly publicized shootings in both Minneapolis and St. Paul over the last couple of years. So, yes, there is a significant problem with especially juveniles, extremely young juveniles, having possession of firearms and their willingness to use them. But Spencer probably could speak more directly.
If I could, just before you speak, Mr. Chair, I appreciate those comments, Senator Harrington. When the others speak, if you could just help me understand then how might we do something about that as you're talking about the issue, if you have any comments on how we might prevent or curtail some of that activity of these kids having guns. Sure. But you
Mr.
can
Chairman,
talk about
it. Senator
Harrington.
Specifically, I know St. Paul is doing some incredibly important work on youth gang prevention, and Officer Spencer is one of the lead people in on the ground in terms of working with parents, especially on youth gang activity. So I'm going to defer to him at this point.
Thank you.
Senator McGuire,
Officer
Mr. Chair.
Spencer.
It's a great question, and I think that right now the golden goose that we're looking at in law enforcement, what is the answer to this issue? And one of the things that we're doing, as Senator Harrington alluded to, is a multi-prong approach. And we're using a multi-agency approach to address some of these problems and partnering with some of our community stakeholders from social services, corrections, probation, in really trying to get these services to these families that are in crisis. So I think that's a key in spending that time in the prevention and intervention end before we do move to that apprehension phase. in the suppression, the gang suppression phase. Speaking back to your question about the weapons and proliferation of weapons within the young population that we deal with our criminal street gangs, I can tell you in my time in St. Paul, I was in the suburban department before I came here in 2000. And I remember when I started as a young cop in St. Paul, there may be a day, you know, that went where a gun was taken off the street. And the rumor went through the PD. That was a big deal. And you might not have heard of another cop recovering a gun for a week. It seems now like it's every shift. And I can tell you a lot of times that those are young criminal street gang members because of the facts that were alluded to earlier, that the older gang members know that the penalties aren't as severe. And a lot of times they'll serve those young gang members up and put them in those positions where they are armed and maybe carrying the gun to the act of violence or secreting it on the way back out.
Senator Harrington, I had a question. Oh, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Harrington, for bringing this forward. Not being totally aware or totally unaware of gang activity in rural Minnesota, in fact, I think it's infiltrating out into the rural communities. I really appreciate the work that you're doing, even after your retirement from the police department. I know you're working very close with that. When we talk about juveniles being utilized here, there's no question about that, and I think they're being utilized for muling as well, aren't they? I mean, isn't that always been a problem? And juvenile offender is going to get less time than an adult offender, so I would say that it's probably pretty accurate to say that they probably are the ones that are doing the drug trafficking or carrying the bag over to somebody else. So this certainly seems to make really good sense to me. I do have a document in the that everybody has here with regards to the opposition. It says the ACLU Minnesota may be opposed to the general concept of the CJI, although not this particular amendment. Can you tell me why in the world they would be against this? Anybody like to comment on that?
Senator Harrington?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm going to defer to Mr. Choi on that one. I have not actually received any correspondence or had any contact from the ACLU in opposition to the criminal gang injunction portion of this or to this particular amendment. But I think Mr. Choi might be in a better position to answer that.
Mr. Choi?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the document was this document that you're looking at was put together last year for the 2011 state legislative proposal. The reason why we put that in there was we wanted all of you to be aware of the fact that the ACLU has made public comments in relation to the civil gang injunctions that were filed in 2009. We had, as was alluded to before, we had three gangs that we were suing, and at that time when the media covered the story, they interviewed the executive director of the ACLU, and he mentioned that he was opposed to the concept. However, they did not intervene or take part in any of the civil lawsuits that were pending in Ramsey County, so they did not take action on their public comments, and I don't know if they're here today to testify to that at all.
Thank you.
Just for the record, is there anyone from the ACLU Minnesota here in the audience that may wish to make comment? Hearing none, I'll ask my own question.
Thank you for your patience, sir.
Perhaps, Mr. Choi, you might be able to answer this. Sometimes in Minnesota we have two different cultures when we deal with gun activities. I'm thinking of the child that might be out in a rural setting and on his own with a 22 rifle plinking at tin cans or something in the back 40 of his local farm. And could he in any way be caught up into this type of net by could that be an unintended consequence of this bill?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question, because I think it's a very thoughtful one and something that we ought to be thinking about. But I really believe that could not be a possibility, because I would refer you to the state statute that references how a juvenile is ineligible to possess a firearm. It talks about all those situations in which a juvenile can lawfully possess a firearm. And I think the scenario that you talked about, I suspect they would fall within one of these particular provisions that would make that possession lawful. Secondly, the scenario in which you're talking about, you don't talk about that particular juvenile being involved in a criminal gang and also involved with a criminal gang that's been involved with gang activity as defined by law. So in order for a city prosecutor or a county prosecutor or the attorney general to proceed, you would have to have, by preponderance of the evidence, proof that those elements exist. And so the example that in which you give, there wouldn't be any way in which someone like that would be included.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Choi, I'm looking at 64.713. Do you have that available to you?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Could you repeat the question?
Senator Newman, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, I'm thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm inquiring as to whether or not Mr. Choi has available to him.
Yes, I do.
The 624.713. And my question, Mr. Choi, is that subdivision 1, subparagraph 1, is that the law that you are referring to and relying on, that the minor who is plinking, as described by the chairman, would not be caught up in this matter?
Correct.
Mr. Choi. Mr. Chairman. Help me then find where in those exemptions the minor out on the farm plinking would be protected, because I'm not seeing it. Believe me, I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
Oh, no, no, no.
I'm just not seeing it.
Well, you know, actually, this, I think, Senator Newman and Mr. Chairman, I think you're correct, but in terms of what this, in terms of the eligible persons provision, so
Mr. Choi, we're going to let counsel weigh in while you continue to read. Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of things. First of all, the 624.713, I believe, just applies to pistols or semi-automatic weapons, so it wouldn't include, say, a rifle. Could include a pistol, though, if someone was out there with a pistol, although they wouldn't be if they'd completed a marksmanship safety course or something. The other thing is that to come in, under the law, you have to have three or more occurrences within a 12-month period. You have to have had three or more offenses within, or activity, gang activity within a 12-month period, so it wouldn't be just like a one-time incident. But it, you know, if it was three within a year, it could be.
Well, Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman.
Could you speak up a little bit? For some reason, I think our amplification kind of slowed down a little.
2 points in reference to Senator Newman's point. One, in order for the youth that we're describing here to be included, they would have to be part of a recognized street gang, which would have to fit the state definition of three or more individuals, a common name or sign or symbol, a recognized name, whose individual or collective activities are directed toward criminal activity. So first of all, they would have to meet that definition. Then, if they met that definition, they would then have to meet the definition of what a gang member is, which would be having met a predicate offense and, in addition, to have had fit three or more of the 10-point criteria. So now we have a second hurdle that they have to overcome to be included in this class. And then, in addition to that, the gang that they're engaged with would have to have had continuous or regular activity, which is the three or more in a 12-month period. So there are three hurdles that would take the kid who's out on the farm plinking, very likely would not be included in this. In addition, under the eligible person statute, if the youth was out there, which, as I would hope, under some parental supervision, then they're not ineligible because they're under parental supervision. Or if they're practicing at a range that has been approved by their local chief or sheriff's department, if that's the kind of practice they're doing, then, once again, that doesn't make them ineligible in that case. So there are several safeguards that I see that are already in existence that would keep us from having the average kid who's out in his backyard, hopefully in rural areas, because it wouldn't be okay in St. Paul. Aside from that, I think that keeps them out of our class of criminal gang members that would be enjoined.
Any other questions? Hearing none. Senator Harrington renews his motion that Senate Bill 1123 be recommended to pass and move directly to the floor. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Harrington.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Choi. Senator Gazelka.
Something to deal with.
Senator Gazelka has Senate File 1371 regarding forfeited firearms. Welcome to the committee, Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if you mind if the local representative from Morrison County attend us or join us here.
Sure, they're anyone's welcome, but bring the microphone close.
I have that problem. I'm too tall up, and I have a gentle voice.
Well, we have a little competition with an open door in the back of the room, so. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to say this is a common sense bill. It came to us from Michael Wessel, the county sheriff of Morrison County, and I'll have him introduce himself in a little bit. But with a simple idea or a simple question, why do we do things the way we do? And in this case, when a local law enforcement confiscates guns, from illegal activities, they are instructed to destroy those guns. Well, frankly, sometimes you have some pretty nice guns. And as a sportsman myself, it's like, why would you destroy some of those guns when instead you could sell them to a registered federal firearms dealer? And that was what Sheriff Wetzel brought to Representative Lemire and myself's attention. And so it fulfills two purposes. One, those guns that are quality guns that we want in the hands of good, honest, law-abiding citizens can still have a way to obtain those guns. And frankly, number two, if they're allowed to sell those, that means that there's going to be more revenue coming into the local sheriff's department in this case, and also the county and the state. And so that's the genesis of this bill. I can tell you that I talked to Representative Lemire. It's already passed the House, or I should say it's on general orders on the House floor at this time.
All right. Thank you. Could we get the testimony first?
Sure.
Senator Goodwin? I promise you'll be the first one to ask.
Mr.
questions.
Chair, we do have a delete all amendment. I wonder, do you want to move that ahead of time? Or?
Senator Newman will move the author's amendment on Senate File 1371. I believe that's the one, the A1 amendment. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yep.
Senator Newman?
Yeah, I so move.
Oh, you
Mr.
so move.
Chairman.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr.
Please
Chair.
Proceed.
At this time, I would like Sheriff Wetzel to talk about the bill as he sees it and the benefit it would have to us.
That's fine. Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sheriff Michael Wetzel from Morrison County.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, currently under state law, I have the authority to sell firearms, cars, other vehicles, precious metals that are seized under the administrative forfeiture bill. That right and that practice is occurring right now. I don't have the right, however, to sell that same sort of firearm if it's taken under summary forfeiture. And I find that inconsistency to be a little bit troubling. First of all, I don't want to inadvertently someday sell a firearm thinking it was administratively forfeited when, in fact, it was summarily forfeited. That little technicality could put me in a jam. But more importantly, I just don't think it's right to take an item of value like a firearm or a car and chop it up and destroy it when I could sell that for $500 or $1,000, and that $1,000 is $1,000 the taxpayers of Morrison County aren't going to have to pay to support our operations. So it's a very simple issue as far as I'm concerned. It is currently authorized by law in many cases, but it's not for summary forfeiture, and I would submit it should be.
Thank you. Who's the other witness here? Could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Representative Mike Lemire, representing Morrison County.
Please proceed.
I am here to support Senator Gazelka's bill. We passed this through the Public Safety Committee last week, and it passed unanimously through over a voice vote. Like Sheriff Wetzel said, this gives the law enforcement agencies one more option. They either, right now, they can use them for training purposes or destroy them. This gives them one more option and allows them the ability to sell the firearm to a federally licensed firearm dealer.
Thank you, Mr. Lemire. Is there further questions? Senator Goodwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, Senator Gazelka, is what is federally licensed firearm dealers? Would those be dealers that did gun shows?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, could you repeat the last?
Would those be federally licensed firearms dealers to gun shows?
I'm not hearing the last word.
Gun shows. Would they be doing gun shows?
Senator Gazelka.
I'm going to let Sheriff Mikkel Wetzel respond to that one.
Sheriff?
Mr. Chair, Madam, I'm not certain because we don't have any gun shows in Morrison County that I'm aware of. Maybe some of the other senators might have more experience with those than I do. But a federally licensed dealer is licensed by ATF. I have noticed that they're federally licensed. Where they sell their firearm, I don't know whether that's regulated, whether it's at a show or their shop. I honestly don't have the answer to that.
Senator Goodwin?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, then I have some concerns. I think really in order to present this bill in a fair way, we really need to know what a federally licensed firearms dealer is and if they're allowed to have gun shows and sell guns, as we know, without much restriction on who they're selling them to. So I would like an answer to that question sometime.
Senator Goodwin, I'm going to ask counsel to weigh
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, I don't know if I have a definitive answer. I could tell you, though, that the definition of firearms dealer, which is cross-referenced in the bill, defines the term as a dealer federally licensed to sell pistols who operates a retail business in which pistols are sold from a permanent business location other than a dealer's home. So in that regard, at the very least, they have to have a retail business at a separate location. Whether they can also sell in a gun show, I don't know, but they have to at least have the storefront, so to speak.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Lemire, did you want to weigh in?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair, if I could. All federally firearms dealers, when they sell a weapon, has to do a background check in order to sell a firearm to an individual.
Senator Goodwin?
Mr. Chair, I don't think that's true at a gun show.
If he's a federal licensed dealer, he has to do a background check.
Any other questions? I have a question, Senator. In the on line 9 of the Delete Everything amendment, there's a reference to the authority that would be selling the weapon. It says they could use it for their own purpose or sell the weapon to a federally licensed dealer. My question is, why don't we auction these weapons rather than just a simple sale? You could still auction them to a federal licensed dealer, but wouldn't an auction generate perhaps a little bit better cash flow? Does anyone have any comment on that?
Mr. Chair, you and I talked about that ahead of time, and after you and I talked to Sheriff Wetzel about that, and I'd like him to give you a perspective
all right
on that.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, what we typically do in Morrison County when we sell firearms that are seized under administrative forfeiture is we sell them by lot, and we notify all of the federally licensed dealers within Morrison County and the nearby ones to come and view that lot and submit sealed bids. We try to do that, of course, to get the most money for them. Auctions are sometimes difficult to manage. We've done them for vehicles and other things, and we're quite honestly not auctioneers. We don't do it very well. Sealed bids seems to be a perfectly acceptable alternative to us. I guess what somebody might be concerned with is that I would just approach one dealer and sell them to him. That certainly wouldn't be our practice, and if we need to make some sort of adjustment in that language, it would not be objectionable to me.
All right. Thank you. Further discussion? Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment on line 0.11 indicates where the proceeds from the sale are to be distributed, and then gives a statutory site. Can you just save me a little time looking it up? Where do the proceeds go after the sale?
Sheriff?
Mr. Chair, that's a standard formula used under administrative forfeiture. 70% of the proceeds of the sale go toward the law enforcement agency, 20% of the proceeds go to the local prosecuting authority, and 10% of the proceeds go to the state of Minnesota. That would be under just about all offenses. The only exception would be under human trafficking offenses. The formula is a little bit different. I believe it is 40% to the agency, 20% to the county attorney, and 40% to the commissioner of public safety. Those are very, very few and far between, at least in greater Minnesota. Not sure about the metro, but I don't know that we've ever had a case like that.
Thank you, Sheriff. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sarah McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to be clear on what I'm looking at with this delete everything. So on line 10, the weapons, you sell the weapons to federally licensed firearms dealers as defined in section 624. Did you just read, is that what defines firearms dealers, or does that define the process that you just talked about? Because I don't mind that process of sealed bids and all of that. I had a similar question as you, Mr. Chair, about auctioning off, but I kind of like the sealed bids. But is that anywhere in this amendment that it talks about that?
Sarah McGuire, I'm going to have our caucus or caucus council Mr. Backus is going to weigh in on this.
He's going to weigh in on just what we're defining here.
Mr. Chair and Senator McGuire, there are two statutory references in the amendment. The first one on line 10, 624.7161 sub 1, that's the definition of firearms dealer that I read earlier.
Okay, right. Okay.
The next reference on line 11 of 609.5315 subdivision 5 or 5B, that's the distribution process of proceeds that the sheriff read. The whole idea of sealed bids or at auction, that's not addressed in either of those two sections.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, then I ask the question, are the law enforcement agencies, is it their choice how they sell those weapons then? I mean, I like, Mr. Chair, you mentioned auction, and you mentioned sealed bids. Is it just whatever the law enforcement agency wants to do, or what governs that?
Sheriff, could you make comment to it?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I don't know exactly what the language of the amendment says or what you would like to amend it to, but it would certainly be preferable from our perspective to leave it at sealed bids. Apparently also that there's a certain number of guns that you're entitled to auction, and if you auction more than that, you need a federal dealer license yourself.
Right.
So I don't anticipate us ever doing that many of them, but in the odd event we would, that would preclude an auction. So I think sealed bids, if any language would be necessary, sealed bids would certainly be acceptable language.
Wow. All right. Mr. Chair,
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know enough about this. I obviously love my colleagues who knows about this also to weigh in. And I know we have another person that's actually going to testify. Are we going to hear from Heather Martin? So I guess, I'm just curious what the best way to do this would be. And then I have one more question, Mr. Chair.
Senator McGuire.
This will... how many guns are we talking about here usually? I mean, how many guns are going to be how many more guns are going to be on the streets with this kind of thing? I mean, I know people can buy them where they are, but are we talking thousands? How many are we talking here? If you would.
Sure.
Please.
Mr. Chair, I certainly have no idea what the statewide impact would be. I know that most small rural law enforcement agencies encounter anywhere from none to maybe 5-10 guns a year. Almost all of them are traditional sporting arms, occasional handguns, legal handguns, of course, to possess. But I don't believe there's any great number of them, but I wouldn't speak with any authority as to what might occur for numbers in a larger metro area.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. McGuire, we have another witness that maybe we can get a little more focus on this.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you have any further witnesses in favor of the bill, Senator Gazelka?
Not at this time.
All right. Anyone opposing the bill? There's a Heather Martins who wishes to speak. Ms. Martins, would you approach the table? Welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity.
Would you identify yourself for the record, please? And could you pull the microphone up close?
A little closer.
Thank you.
Is that good? You can hear me?
I think so.
My name's Heather Martens, and I'm Executive Director of Protect Minnesota, working to end gun violence. We're an organization representing 7,000 Minnesotans who are interested in ending gun violence and are very concerned about public safety. We support the full funding of local law enforcement agencies. I understand there is a question of getting revenue for local law enforcement. We do support fully funding local law enforcement. But we don't believe that selling seized firearms or forfeited firearms is an appropriate thing for our law enforcement to be doing. We believe what we would like our law enforcement to be doing is to not contribute to the availability of potentially cheap firearms on the market, and we do see this from a more urban perspective. When we looked into this a bit in other states, it has been the case that firearms that were sold in this way in Tennessee have ended up in high-profile shootings in other states, and one of those incidences was in Nevada, where at a Las Vegas courthouse, Johnny Lee Wicks, who had a felony record and he could not legally possess a firearm, used one of these guns that had been sold in Tennessee to open fire at a courthouse and killed a security officer and wounded another. In a second case at the Pentagon shooting, which was also all over, people were very aware of that at the time, this person, Patrick Bedell, had just received a letter that he was disqualified from owning a gun because he was seriously mentally ill. He bought a 9mm Ruger handgun at a gun show from a seller there, and he used that to open fire at the Pentagon. So our concern is that the amount of money that could be raised through this is not substantial. The Arizona Republic estimated for their entire state maybe $10,000 to $20,000 could be raised this way, as the guns are not sold at very high prices, and that the concern would be that people who are seeking a cheap firearm could very well be someone with criminal intent or someone with intent to commit suicide. So those are both very real public health hazards that we're concerned about. And I guess I would just like to close with the role of law enforcement should not be to raise money or to take part in that market for that purpose, that their role is primarily to protect the public. And I thank you for your
thank you, Ms. Martins. Senator Thompson.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question. You indicated that people on the street may try to obtain inexpensive guns. What would make you think that a firearms dealer would be selling a gun less expensively because they had obtained it from, for example, the Morrison County sheriff's office as opposed to just a gun they acquired through their normal wholesale chains.
What I was able to obtain in terms of information about what these look like, since that it's not a common occurrence in this state, is that if you do go to one of these sales, most of the guns that you do see there are cheap, not very good quality guns. It's not really a place where a collector's item could be found. So it's just a different. It's more like the Saturday night special that you would find at these sales.
For a follow-up.
My anecdotal.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. But if that gun happened to have been obtained through this process that we would have in place, assuming Senator Gazelka succeeds and the bill gets signed into law, I guess I don't understand why, if they bring in a used firearm that perhaps isn't in perfect condition, that where they purchased it would make a difference in the price.
I think the point that I was making is that these are additional guns that are coming directly from law enforcement, and the concern is that those guns are going right back into the market. It's additional guns. I mean, supply and demand. As there are more out there, the price does go down.
Mr. Chair
Goodwin. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Gazelka?
To that point, I think Michael Wetzel has some comments related to that.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, very briefly, a couple of the examples the witness uses could not have purchased those firearms from a federally licensed dealer. They had criminal backgrounds. They would not have been eligible to purchase those. They may have purchased them off the street from somebody else, but they certainly would not have come from a law enforcement agency through a federally licensed dealer. They weren't eligible. I'm not sure if there was another question in there or not, Senator.
Well, I think the other part was related to the cost it takes to bring a gun through a dealer and then sell it. If you have an inexpensive gun, I don't think that's where you're going to find those kind of guns anyway.
All right. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Martin, I'd like to ask you a couple questions, too. And I think what you said is very interesting about having our law force agencies selling weapons. It's really kind of it's a bad image to me. But at any rate, I want to know if you knew whether or not federally licensed firearms dealers were able to have gun shows.
Yes, I've been to gun shows, and there are – oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. And there are, at those gun sales, both federally licensed firearms dealers who have to conduct background checks, and there are also private sellers who do not. So this person, Mr. Bedell, apparently went to one of the unlicensed sellers at a gun show in order to buy his gun, and there was no background check required. And that's a problem with a different part of the law. However, the point is that just because we're selling it originally to a federally licensed firearms dealer does not mean that that's going to stay out of the hands of a criminal.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
And so what could happen here is that the firearms dealers, licensed firearms, federal firearms dealers, could sell it to these people that are going to run a show that doesn't do any background checks, as long as they were legitimate and didn't fall under suspicion and couldn't get these arms. They could sell these firearms to anybody that runs these shows. Is that correct?
They could.
Ms. Martins.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes, my understanding is that the promoter for the firearm sales or for the gun show sets up the gun show and invites those vendors, the firearms dealers, as well as the individuals who don't have firearms licenses. So it can happen at a gun show, yes.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that this morning on the Today Show, they had a very good research project going on where they showed how easy it was for even formerly convicted felons to get guns, background check or not, that it was really easy. I think this makes it even easier, so I would oppose this bill.
Any other discussion regarding Senate File 1371?
Oh.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, after all the testimony, what would it take to identify how they're going to sell these bills? It just goes back to my conversation about maybe not at auction, but at sealed bid or something like that? Or is that a different – I don't know if I'm prepared to amend – I mean, I don't know. I there's a way I propose that we have these sold. I don't know.
But. Well, Senator, the way it's described now is in the proposal on the Delete Everything Amendment. Are you suggesting a different manner that's prescribed by law?
What way is it to be sold? How does it say?
I believe it's under the line 11. Oh, no, that's under proceeds.
No.
Wouldn't that be on line 10, the section 624-7161?
No, that defines a firearms dealer, Mr. Chair. As far as I understand,
Mr. Chair and members, under the amendment, the requirement is that the weapons would be sold to a federally licensed firearms dealer. There's no specification as to what that process would be. The original bill required it be via an auction. So one option could be to reinsert that, but the sheriff said that might be a little restrictive. You could maybe say something like at auction or using a sealed bid process, give them the option of that. Another option could be under the other law, whereby law enforcement can sell firearms under other forfeiture provisions. There's a general requirement that a sale must be conducted in a commercially reasonable manner. You could cross-reference that if you'd like.
McGuire, do you have any suggestions? We're giving you options.
I know, I guess. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I need more information on which I would want. I appreciate. I wanted to, if it's going to be sold at all, and I'm nervous about having more guns on the street. But I absolutely want it to be to someone who's going to be. I mean, I want to require a background check to whoever gets these guns. You know, and
Senator Gazelka, I'm going to ask counsel to repeat that last option. And I want you to listen carefully to it and see if it's something that may give us a little bit of comfort language on your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, again, if you were to refer to Section 609.5315, Subdivision 1, that law applies generally to controlled substance forfeitures, drive-by shooting forfeitures, designated offense forfeitures. And within that provision, there already is authority for law enforcement in certain cases to sell firearms. And there's no requirement that it be at an auction. However, there are some general provisions that apply to any sale for any type of item forfeited under those statutes. And it includes, for example, it includes that you can't, the law enforcement agency can't sell to certain employees or fellow officers or family. There's also a separate provision that they can't sell, that it has to be sold in a commercially reasonable manner. So again, one option for you is if you want to cross-reference, you know, either both of those or at the very least the provision on commercially reasonable manner. However, under the bill and under the amendment, either way it has to go to a federally licensed dealer. So it can't just go to anybody. It has to go to that type of person.
Senator Gazelka?
Yep. Mr. Chair, would that then still allow sealed bids as an option?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe it would. The idea of what is commercially reasonable, it's kind of you're going into the Uniform Commercial Code, which is a little outside my jurisdiction, but, you know, I think that would be viewed as being commercially reasonable.
Senator Ingebrigtsen first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Sheriff, for coming today to testify. I bring some experience to the committee, being a sheriff myself back in the 90s when I think it was probably back, well, it was before the law enforcement agencies had a problem selling confiscated weapons, but it was a tremendous tool for law enforcement at that time, and it still is, to be able to turn those dollars around and utilize them for whatever, drug enforcement, drug education, maybe even purchasing ammunition for the deputies that wouldn't have to come out of the local taxpayer. The whole point here, folks, and I think what's getting lost here in this is that these guns are legal guns. These are legal guns to actually possess. They're like the guns that Senator Gazelka and I have, and probably the sheriff and several of us on the committee have in our gun cabinets. These are guns that are going back into the community. that it would be just a shame, absolute shame, to have them ground up and thrown away. The sheriff here is also, and I've known him for years, is very concerned about gun violence. To sit up there and say that we sheriffs wouldn't, chiefs wouldn't be wanting to see gun violence end, I don't think there's any implication of that, but we'd be the first ones to step up and say, boy, that'd be a pretty nice job we had if we didn't have gun violence. It really has nothing to do with it. These are guns that are used in the field every day. The guns that are MAC-5s and illegal weapons to go out that are confiscated are not going out. They're not being sold. And any sheriff or chief that would do that is putting themselves out really in a bind that they don't want to be at. And for someone to say that these weapons going on to the, being sold back to FFLs who can sell any kind of a weapon they want that's legal, to say that this piece of legislation would be adding to violence, street violence out there, is a real stretch. I mean, it is a huge stretch. In fact, it's false. Maybe we should stop selling cars that we confiscate in drug operations because, you know, cars kill people too. Where does this foolishness ever end? This is just foolish. So I would really like to see this back to where it was before. Those dollars are being our dollars are being stretched locally at the local level and state level. There's a mechanism in place to distribute those dollars in a proper fashion to help offset the costs. I don't think there's any sheriffs or chiefs that are going to go out and say, boy, I got a whole bunch of guns for sale here, and all the bad guys' ears are going to perk up because that's going to put a lot more of them on the street, quite frankly. The folks that are going to buy those, the majority of those guns are law-abiding citizens, and they just have an opportunity to purchase a gun. But one of the questions and concerns that I may have, Sheriff or Senator, would be, what is your feeling of selling a weapon that was used in a crime such as a murder weapon or a heinous crime, whether it be a good sawed-off, a regular shotgun that I use to hunt ducks with or whatever. What is your feeling? I guess there's never been any discussion about where those particular guns go. What would you do with those guns?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator, first of all, if it was a homicide, we can't sell those. We have to retain that evidence forever until everyone involved is passed away. So homicide cases wouldn't be involved here. Other crimes, though, those potentially could be sold. I guess I look at it the same way as the 2005 Cadillac Escalade that was involved in a serious felony DUI crime. We can sell that. Is it possible that that car will some day again be used in another DUI offense? Of course it's possible. But I don't think we're certainly adding to the likelihood that car will be involved in a crime any more than we would be adding to the likelihood that another crime would be committed if a gun used in a holdup was resold. If it's a perfectly legal, legitimate firearm, I don't think we'd be adding anything to the equation or making public any less safe by selling that gun back out.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, that, you know, my comment would be we've gotten way off track with, well, what do federally licensed firearms dealers do and the like. The point is we've got a fairly substantial body of federal law. In fact, some of us think too substantial regarding firearms, and so do the states. And all this is doing is saying, can our law enforcement folks use this avenue to get back some revenue for the taxpaying citizens by selling to the very kinds of people we require to go through a fairly rigorous process to be licensed to handle these kinds of assets. And so, you know, I don't think we need to get off into, well, what happens when a licensed firearm dealer does this, and does it go to a gun show, and does somebody get it who shouldn't? There's a body of law dealing with that, what federally licensed firearms dealers have to do. And it's a system that has been approved at the federal level, and it's in place. And this simply says that this sheriff, as well as others, have the opportunity to put the firearm into the legitimate, federally regulated supply chain and get back some money for the taxpayers. I'll go with Senator Ingebrigtsen. I think it's incredible common sense.
Senator Harrington.
Or my career at St. Paul PD, this approach to handling firearms has changed over the number of years. When I first came on the job, handguns that were or firearms that were confiscated were routinely given back to the officers. In fact, that took them off the streets because, as Officer Spencer mentioned, it was such a rare occasion that back in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, it was considered almost like it was a badge of recognition that you were one of the few cops that ever got a gun off the street. By the time I left the department, St. Paul PD was taking about 2 guns a day off the streets. I think Minneapolis is averaging 3 guns a day off the streets. And we had tightened up substantially how we handled those guns. Having said that, though, our department policy on administrative forfeiture did allow us to sell weapons. And we made a policy decision at that time that we would only sell long guns and antiques. And we only sold them to federally firearms licensed dealers, in part because to do anything other than that really felt like we were skirting the law, and we wanted to make sure that everything was as above board and as transparent as we possibly could. There was great pressure during my time as chief as the budget cycles kept coming in pretty bad ways with cuts to local government aid, which oftentimes made the mayor make some significant cuts to police, and we were asked the question, would we sell firearms, would we expand what we sold? And we made a policy decision that while we would continue to our past practice on administrative forfeiture of selling long guns, hunting rifles, things along that lines, we were going to hold the line at certain types of firearms. And I think that's the prerogative of the individual departments. I think it's appropriate that they are allowed to sell them to FFLs. FFLs are regulated. They are checked. They have to do the backgrounds. They lose their license. They lose their livelihood. There is a lot of checks and balances with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms in checking this. I will close with saying that as we were making those decisions about whether or not whether the St. Paul Police Department wanted to be involved in selling firearms at all, I thought it was quite honestly a values question as to what we wanted to do. I will tell you that a lot of my colleagues on the national scene, Chief John Timoney, who was the chief of police down in Miami, feels, as the testifier does, that selling firearms by a police department is an untoward activity and that it shouldn't happen. But I think departments have to live within the means that they have, and I think they have to make some decisions. I personally feel that selling firearms to FFLs doesn't pose any great threat. But I am very aware of some of the horror stories of guns that have fallen back into the hands, not typically from FFLs. More often, those are private sales. Those are the swap meet sales where it's not an FFL selling it. It's more typically a private owner selling it to another private individual where those guns fall into hands. But I am we're always very, very aware of what any firearm could do. We know that while most firearms are used lawfully and legitimately, it doesn't take much for it to fall into one of the hands of the juveniles that I described in my preceding bill and suddenly become a deadly weapon in the hands of someone who has neither the maturity nor the judgment nor the legal right to handle that. So I think we should act with caution, but I would concur with Senator Thompson on this particular piece. What we're being asked to do here is to change to add summary forfeiture to administrative forfeiture. I don't see this as a huge opening of a window. I think, in fact, the numbers on summary forfeiture are far smaller than what we pick up on administrative forfeiture typically.
Thank you. Senator Harrington, just real briefly, the bill that Senator Gazelka has, that would not change the choice element of a city if they wish to sell or not to sell. That would be left to them. And this bill does not restrict them in any way on that policy. Is that how you read it?
That's how I read it. I believe if the city of St. Paul, Chief Tom Smith decided he didn't want to sell firearms anymore, that's a local decision that he could make. And if Chief Tim Dolan decided he wanted to, I don't think this bill forces them to do it or change their policy at this point.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a couple of quick questions before we vote on this. Does this apply to state agencies, too, like the DNR and other agencies that may confiscate weapons?
Mr. Chair, I don't know why it would not.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chair, do we have a fiscal note on this?
There is not a fiscal note yet, but I am fairly convinced it would be positive.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Turner could answer that question, perhaps.
Mr. Chairman, members, I did not request a fiscal note because these guns are being forfeited and being destroyed right now, and they would simply be sold. If there's a fiscal note, it would have a positive revenue impact.
Well, yes, it would, Mr. Chair, and I'm thinking that this should get a fiscal note before we go any further with it. I would just recommend we lay this over until we have a fiscal note to see what the effect is going to be on the state agencies.
Are you putting that in the form of a motion,
yes,
Senator
I am.
Goodwin? Senator Goodwin moves that the bill be laid on the table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Is there any further discussion regarding Senate File 1620? Senator McGuire?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had asked questions about, you know, the selling language, so I'm just asking the people that know best, are you comfortable that this is the appropriate language that we need to give you the option to either have open bid? I prefer not auction for the reasons that we said, but are we comfortable? I'm asking my colleague, Senator Harrington, and the officer, and Senator Engelbretson, is this good language?
Senator McGuire is polling the committee.
I'm not the expert on this. Yeah, I'm not the expert on this language, but I want to. I'm asking the people that know more about it.
Senator Harrington, would you wish to answer that? Would you yield, Senator Harrington?
My experience, Mr. Chair, my experience with this was that we did use auction for many of the things that we picked up on administrative forfeiture, cars, jewelry, tools. My recollection is we did not use auction for firearms, and that we were using a contract with a FFL dealer to transfer our firearms through them so that, once again, all of the safeguards, all of the checks that need to be made would be made by an appropriate authority rather than the police department getting itself into that position.
Right.
So the auction language is, I thought, was a little odd, but if they're being auctioned to FFLs.
It's not auction, it just says.
So,
this is a deleted.
Okay. Senator Engelbretson, would you?
Thank you. I'm just, as I'm sitting here in my former life, I guess I would want the opportunity to be able to do as the sheriff wants, to be able to put it out to all the FFLs in my area. I think that would be the fairest way to do it. I think it could be somewhat costly to local units of government if the sheriff's going to go out and sell each individual gun to every FFL. So this basically gets rid of it at one time, and it seems like it's just a real good way to do it.
And it's still limiting the sale to those that are authorized to purchase,
right,
federally licensed.
And if I could make one more comment before you move on, and I know you want to move on, but I remember some things in the past, too, that the chief, I'm sure, remembers, is that gun legislation has always been very, I guess you'd say tenuous. And you've seen things like the buybacks. You remember some years ago when and the chief probably remember, it might have happened in St. Paul where they were offering up $50 per gun that would come in, and they would actually grind them up and saw them up and cut them up. And frankly, you know, that was a good program. I'm not sure where the funding came from. But, again, it felt good, really. If I'm a bad guy out there and I want to go out and commit crimes, I'm going to say, you know what, there's less guns out there now that I got to worry about when I stick it in the face of that person down at the local gas station. They don't really care. You know, they just really don't care. If they're going to do that, they're going to go out and steal my gun. They're going to steal your gun. They're going to do that. That's just what's going to happen. So, I mean, there's been a lot of ways to try and get all the guns off the street, but I'm here to tell you, just – isn't going to happen. I mean, there's just always going to be guns there, and to be able to utilize this as a tool for law enforcement or a local unit of government to be able to supplement, it's a great way. It's a great idea.
Hearing no further discussion. Oh, Senator Lance, I'm sorry.
I had anticipated Senator McGuire might follow up on this, but I'm most comfortable having the any weapons that are sold go through the same sales process as required for the administrative forfeiture items. And so if I understood the discussion correctly, as Mr. Backus indicated, that process has the commercially reasonable requirement in it and has some other requirements that made sense to me. I don't know why we would exempt summary forfeitured weapons from going through a process that administratively forfeitured weapons have to go through. If the agencies are already going through that other process and aren't complaining about it, it seems to me it makes sense to run these items through that process as well. So I'd like to offer an amendment to that effect.
Okay. Could you state your amendment?
Well, maybe Mr. Backus has some language he's been thinking about to that specific effect, or just make a cross-reference to the process must be of sale must be handled in the same way as under the administrative forfeiture provision under 609.15315 sub 1.
Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, I do have some various types of language scribbled, including one that would cross-reference specifically those two of those paragraphs from the other law, the one that has to do with not selling to relatives and fellow peace officers within the department, and the other one talking about commercially reasonable. You know, those provisions were added to that law really not specific to firearm sales. They were just added for any sale. So, you know, really, would you really need to say that you can't sell to, say, a fellow officer or a family member when the only way you could do it under the law anyway would be if they were a federally licensed dealer? So I don't know if you really want to refer to both of them. You certainly could. Maybe the simplest way to do it is just after page 1, line 9, after weapons, just insert in a commercially reasonable manner and just pick up that requirement. That seems a pretty simple way to get what everyone's interested in.
Senator Lapp?
I so move.
All right. Does everyone understand the amendments? Any further discussion?
Yes, Mr. Do you insert the language, Mr. Chairman?
Counsel, could you restate the location and the wording of the language?
Mr. Chair and members, on page 1, line 9, after weapons, insert in a commercially reasonable manner.
The second weapons?
I'm sorry, yes, the new weapons being added, the underscored weapons, the second one.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, if he chooses, I would like to hear from the author of the bill, Senator Gazelka.
Right. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What do you
Chair,
think of Senator Latz's amendment?
Thank you. We are we consider that a friendly amendment.
Any further discussion? Hearing none on the Latz amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Having the bill before us. Hearing no further discussion.
What?
Senator Ingram?
I could just ask one more question, because I like to belabor things a lot.
One more.
Sheriff, if I could, the weapons that are confiscated, they'll still be able to be utilized by law enforcement if you deem necessary. Because some of the guns, you may want to just mention that some of the guns that are being confiscated are the very same guns that are being used in law enforcement. Are you still able to do that under current law?
Sheriff?
Mr. Chair, yes, Senator. That language is still in there that we can either retain them for use or sell them.
And then on that.
Senator McGuire?
But if you do have a gun that, like a sniper rifle or something that you don't want to have anywhere, you can still destroy that too, right? You have all these options still, right?
Sheriff? Yeah. Sheriff nodded yes.
Okay.
All right. Hearing no further discussion, Senator Newman moves that Senate File 1371 be recommended to pass as amended and be moved to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted. There's no further business before the committee. The committee is adjourned.